This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the second meeting of our class on the historical Yeshua. The name of last week's lecture was Call Me Yeshua, and we made an effort to change his name in order to defamiliarize ourselves with inherited notions about Jesus of Nazareth. A governor of the Grand State of Texas in the 1920s was Miriam Amanda Ferguson. Her initials were M.A., so they called her Ma Ferguson. And she was the wife, as you might guess, of Pa Ferguson. James Ferguson had been governor before her. He was famous for basically defunding the University of Texas because he disagreed with what they were teaching there. But Ma Ferguson did him one better. Texas was actually very progressive in the 1920s and the early 30s when she was governor, and the legislature passed the first bill in the United States, as far as I know, that would allow the teaching of kindergarten and early grade schools in Spanish in order to help children who were immigrants across the border from Mexico or who just weren't fluent in English. And Ma Ferguson famously vetoed the bill. And when she was asked by the reporters why she vetoed the bill, her answer was straight out of scripture: if English was good enough for Jesus Christ, it's good enough for Texas school children. We'll let that stand for a certain attitude about the scriptures that we're trying to counteract in our course. It's the problem of being too familiar with the scriptures and too familiar with what allegedly they contain, and that familiarity can be the enemy of truth. And unfortunately, it's a familiarity that's held by the man and woman in the street, many of the ministers and pastors of the various Christian churches. What we tried to do last time, and what I'll do now, is review some of last class and then launch into today's material. We asked ourselves whether we knew the real history of Jesus. We decided that his name wasn't Jesus, but that his Aramaic name was Yeshua, in modern Hebrew, Yeshu, and that his last name was not Christ, not even Mashiach, the Hebrew origin of the word Christ. He didn't have a last name. He was Yeshua, the son of Joseph of the town of Nazareth. We talked about the difference between two kinds of history. I'll call it historiography, two different ways of writing history. One is secular history. We sometimes call it profane history. It doesn't mean that it's vulgar, it just means that it's not sacred. And the other is sacred history, salvation history, that is often contained in the religious texts of a given culture. When it comes to the Hebrew scriptures, we'll call them Tanakh, and I'll explain why in a moment, and the Christian scriptures, the issue of whether you read sacred history into today or read today and the past in a secular historiographical way is very important. We asked who owns that piece of land between the Mediterranean and Jordan, and who says they own it. If you go into the past, we find out that the original owners of the land were Canaanites. However, in the Hebrew scriptures, in Tanakh, God promises to Abraham that not only he will have many children, but that they will own that land. And the promise is renewed various times. But as Jerry Falwell and all good Christians know, ultimately that land is going to belong to King Jesus. Because at the end of time, he's going to return in the area of northern Israel by the town of Megiddo, by a mountain of Megiddo, that means Harmageddon, and Armageddon is therefore the name of the place. He's going to, at that point, defeat the enemies of goodness, and will offer the Jews one last chance to accept him as their savior. And if they refuse, they will be slaughtered. In any case, King Jesus, according to Jerry Falwell and other fundamentalist readers of the scriptures, say that then King Jesus will rule in what we now know as Israel in the West Bank for 1,000 years. So Can you use sacred history, whether it be Jewish or it be Christian, to decide who owns that land? That's a secular issue that I have no intention of getting into or deciding here. But I want to point out that we have problems if we accept sacred history, and the Christian scriptures have particular problems. We pointed out that they do not agree at all on major issues in the sacred life of Yeshua, not just minor ones about what he said and when he said it and what he did. The major issues concern the framing of his life, the theological framing that takes place at his birth and at the end of his life. Was he conceived by and born of a virgin? Was he visited by wise men, which would be a sign of his messianic dignity? Or at the end of his life, did he indeed come out of a tomb on April 9th of the year 30 CE? Did he ascend into heaven that night, or was it 40 days later? Even Luke, the only person who describes the ascension, can't decide which day it was, so he gives both days. Which leads us to the question, are we dealing in the scriptures with secular history that we would expect to tell us, as von Ranke once said, what actually happened, wie es eigentlich gewesen? Or are we dealing with a theocratic rereading of historical events for religious purposes? In a neutral sense of the word propaganda, the question would be, are the scriptures, both the Tanakh and the Christian scriptures, religious propaganda, an effort to convince people? In any case, we agreed, I hope, that our approach would be historical science rather than sacred history. What if we locked up in this room ourselves, as if this were a papal conclave, and we'd feed ourselves, we'd have sandwiches and Chinese sent in, but regardless of our religious commitments, whether we're atheists, agnostics, Hindus, Sikhs, Christians of what other stripe, Jews, Muslims, etc., we would be good historians. We'd be educated, intelligent historians. We would have all the evidence at our disposal, and they wouldn't let us out until we came up with an historical consensus about Yeshua of Nazareth, or, in tonight's case, about what happened in the history of the Israelites and the Jews. However, even though the science of history is our method in this class, there's lots of problems with history, beginning with the meaning of the word. History has at least three meanings. It can refer to events in the past, or it can refer to the books that are written in this building, this is the History Corner, by professors of history. We use the word history for that, but we really mean historiography, the writing of history. And thirdly, in a certain adjectival meaning, history can be read as historic if it has impact on us. So events, the interpretation of events, and the impact of events. How do we know events? You who are a generation of media watchers know that our first encounter with events, political, social, economic events, is not an encounter with the event. It's an encounter with CNN's interpretation of the event, or Fox News, or the New York Times, or whomever you will. We get our events interpreted for us. We get it through intermediaries. And the possibility is that the intermediary has an agenda. That's why the history books that I studied in the 40s and the 50s, I'm telling you something about my age, and even into the 60s, forgot to mention that there were Native Americans here before we came to reach the Pacific Coast. Now, in the latter years, as you know, history books have changed momentously to reflect gender, racial diversity, etc. You have to look to the interest, if you will, the bias, the agenda in any case, of the one who is interpreting it. But we do have another way of looking at events in history, a more objective way, which is the fairly new science of archaeology. Now, indeed, archaeology, which gets closer to the material culture and the material objects, rather than reading the past through texts, through, let us say, the Tanakh or the New Testament, right? Nonetheless, there too, interpretation is essential to the task. You pick up a little piece of pottery, and you have to be able to place it in its context. You have to be able to decide whether it's from that tribe or this. There are a lot of interpretation going on there. But in any case, our first encounter with events is through mediation. But a third way that we encounter events is through our own interest in them, our own agendas. Sometimes we skip over the historiography and we accept popular interpretations precisely because we have an investment in them being true and having import for us. That's where the historic, by which I mean my decision that this will and does impact me, can override historiography in its interpretation of events. But the threefoldness of data or events, interpretation, and impact means that we've got some distinctions to make and some problems with the notion of history. We in this class hope to know the, first of all, the received history. History the way it's understood generally in our culture about ancient Israel, about the period between 2000 CE and the time of Yeshua in our tonight's lecture. We want to understand what history as received tells us. So we'll have to put up on the in a chart in a moment what the received history is. But because of that interpretative factor in historiography, we have to suspect, we have to be a bit suspicious about the received interpretation. That is to say, we take a critical point of view, where critical doesn't mean negative and carping. Critical just means making reasoned judgments based on evidence, based on hypotheses, based on the best verification that we can carry out. So, received history, a critical review of that, and then a reconstruction that we are responsible for, that we simply don't receive, but that we can actually sign off on. So now we begin the material that's specific to this evening, after that brief and no doubt inadequate review of the past. I'd like to begin by talking about the controversies that surround the question of the history of ancient Israel, of basically the period from 2000 up to the Second Temple. That's going to be our general topic tonight. Controversies are raging on all fronts, among Israeli archaeologists and historians, among non-Israeli archaeologists and historians, whatever their religious commitments might be. And it would be good for us at least to know that there is, while there is a sense, a consensus that is emerging on all sides, it is, for the popular imagination, quite shocking. What we'll find in the coming weeks is that the same sort of new consensus, scientific historical consensus, about the life and words and deeds of Yeshua and what became of them afterwards in the life and culture of his followers is also shocking. Why are these things shocking? Because the evidence will not support a lot of the superstructure, religious in particular, but also political and social, that has been built on a certain familiar interpretation of the data. The real dividing line for the science of scientific exegesis of the scriptures, where exegesis means interpreting in all senses and getting to the meaning behind it, is around the year 1800. And in the last 200 years, we have learned such an amazing amount of information, and it accelerates each decade, so that in the last 30 years, we've learned so much more about the history of Israel than we ever knew before. How will I undo that? I'll just close it, maybe?
The power up above on the actual projector.
Is that this power here?
Not that one.
Is that it? That did it?
Perfect.
All right. We'll get to that eventually, please. It's going to be fun. So, what we're after are the state of the science, which is controversy issuing in a fairly widespread consensus. As you know, in science, we move by consensuses rather than by the absolute truth. Religion may have absolute truth, but science doesn't. It's forever falsifying inadequate results and finding better results. Every professor fears that his graduate student represents the end of his research, right? Because it just gets better each time. As I like to say to the dinosaurs, look out for those little mammals. There is a succession of evolution in science and in history in particular that overturns paradigms that once seemed sure. Imagine that up until 1930, we thought there was only one galaxy in the whole of the universe, and it was, of course, ours. And then around 1930, after many suspicions, Hubble proved, I guess we can say that, proof being never the last word but the best word, with all the evidence, proved that, no, the universe is expanding, and nowadays we think there are about 200 billion such galaxies. So hang on to your socks, things are moving very fast. Let me point to two controversies, and they deal with the two sources that we have for organizing the history of ancient Israel. Those two sources are, in general terms, texts and archaeology. Texts, both sacred and secular. Secular texts would be, for example, steles from northern Egypt. A stele is a pillar with an inscription on it. Right? Or it will be Neo-Assyrian or Neo-Babylonian texts. Those would be non-sacred for people in the Jewish or the Christian tradition. Then there are sacred texts, obviously the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures. Right? On the other hand, we've got archaeology. So let's look at both of these fields in turn, give a little bit of history for how they got where they are now, and see if we can learn something about all of these. Textual issues, first of all. The big question is, what did the Bible writers know and when did they know it? Or, who wrote the Bible and when was that Bible written? Was it dictated by Moses to his secretaries, amanuensis, which was held well into the 20th century? Was it inspired by God? If you go to a certain church in Rome near Piazza Navona, it's called San Luigi dei Francesi, St. Louis of the French, you'll see a beautiful painting of St. Matthew writing his gospel, painted by Caravaggio, so around 1610 or 20, etc. And an angel is actually whispering into Matthew's ear, and he's got his ear kind of cocked with his pen, his quill in one hand. Is it inspired? Separate from that question, distinct from it, is it inerrant? Again, Jerry Falwell has said it's not only inerrant in moral matters and in theological matters, but it's also inerrant, cannot make a mistake, in geography, science, etc. He said that in a book called Listen, America. What are the various sources of the Bible, or was it written all in one off, we might say? What is the structure of the Bible? How is it divided? We're talking now about Tanakh, about the Hebrew scriptures. What do we mean by saying Moses wrote the Pentateuch, or that the books of the prophets, were they written by the prophets in the 800s, the 700s, the 600s? There's lots of issues here. Those are the problems. Here's how the solution has unfolded. As I say, the birth of historical consciousness sometime in the late 1700s and the early 1800s, it never happens, these things never happen out of people's heads, that some bright woman or man says, I think we need a little history around here. Usually, ideas follow events, political, social, economic events. And I think it's fair to say that the big event took place in the summer of 1789, and it was, for Europe, earth rocking, right? And it was, of course, the beginnings of the French Revolution. The king at the time, looking out his window and, you know, seeing the crowds shouting and screaming outside his window at Versailles, is said to have turned to his valet and said, it is a revolt. And the valet said, no, sire, it is a revolution. Things were turning and they weren't going to go back to the way they were. It wasn't just an upstart thing. And that whole period in which people saw that they were actually making their own lives instead of receiving from the church, from the monarchy, from the powers that be, wealth, etc., receiving what was to be the case. When they found out that worlds were, to use our modern terms, socially constructed, that roles were socially constructed, that the king was simply Mr. Citizen Louis rather than a divine right monarch, that was the beginnings, I think it's fair to say, of a revolution in ideology in the way we think about historical consciousness. And accompanying all of that, there was among the scholars, I think immediately we all think of Leopold von Ranke, who in 1825 began his history career, which spanned most of the 19th century, who really insisted that we get back to sources, get those sources right, work out hypotheses, not try to use history as moral education or as lessons for our children, just to find out what the hell happened, we might to translate this thing. Well, correspondingly, In the area of scripture scholarship, there are three names that I will mention. Two of them are devoted to finding out what the text was about. And one of them is trying to get behind the text to the history that's operative there. So, J.G. Eichhorn, that would be spelled E-I-C-H-H-O-R-N, a German professor who taught at Jena and at Göttingen and who died in 1827, so he's doing his major work in the 1790s and early, is considered to be the father, the origin of what we call historical critical method. Notice, critical doesn't mean negative or carping, it doesn't mean tearing down, it just means making reasonable judgments about history, scientific judgments about history. In the 1780s, he wrote a famous book that is the introduction to the Old Testament, Einleitung in das Alte Testament. It was three volumes long, and that's where he laid out the principles for what came to be known as higher criticism. Here's the distinction. Criticism means making reasonable judgments, in this case about the scriptures. Higher criticism versus lower criticism. Not that the lower criticism is any less important, but lower criticism means let's just get Tanakh right. Let's find out what are the best texts, what are the variant texts, and let's see if we can get a decent text that we can publish and say this is as close as we can get to what we think was the original literary production. That means this, that is set, by the way, in contrast to higher criticism, where we begin to ask deeper questions, if you will. Who wrote this book? Why was it written? What's its theology? What does it reflect about the culture of its times? For example, was ancient Israel monotheistic? That they believed in only one god, and every other god was, you drew an X through it, they were only idols. Or were they henotheistic? These words come from the Greek. Mono means one alone, counts as God. Henotheistic means my God is the one God I worship, and I realize that there are other gods that are taking care of other countries, but I only go with this God here. That would be a realm of higher criticism. But most importantly for Eichhorn's reputation, his place in history, is the fact that he evolved what we now call the documentary hypothesis. So it's a theory about how the Pentateuch in particular, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, got written. In reading that text in the Hebrew, which he knew extremely well as of course his Greek, his Latin, his German, his French, and all those other languages that they were competent at that time, he noticed in the Hebrew the obvious fact that throughout the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, at least two names are used for the Most High. One of those names builds on the Canaanite name, the Semitic name of the region for the high God, and that name is El. It's reflected still in the word Allah in Arabic today. El means God. And interestingly, whoever were the authors of the book of Genesis, for example, use it in the plural as El-Oim, the Im being the plural. So it actually means the gods, but in the sense of all of their powers summed up in this one god, probably a henotheistic god, right? They're still understanding that other countries may have their gods, but we don't believe in them. We don't pay any heed to them. And then secondly, he noticed that another name that gets used in the Pentateuch for God is the tetragrammaton, the four-letter word that is never pronounced, which, if pronounced, as it is by non-Orthodox Jews, would sound something like Yahweh. We usually write it in capital letters, YHWH. The Germans, however, spelled it with a J, Yahweh with a J. And so, what Eichhorn began to do, and what his followers followed up on, was to sort out from the Torah those texts that use Elohim and those texts that use Yahweh. And attribute them to two different sources that eventually got intertwined by a redactor, an editor, later on. That was his first move. He was also able to distinguish within the Elohist tradition what he called Elohist 1 and Elohist 2. There were variations, so we're beginning to get the sense that the book of Genesis and the rest of the Torah, the first five books, were not written by a single author. They were written, rather, by people who represented communities of interest with different religious practices, different even names for their one God. So that becomes very interesting, doesn't it? Now we're dealing with higher criticism of the literary dimension. We've established the text. We're forever finding points to be made on that, improvements to be made. But we're beginning to sort out the J community, or J author, J texts, from the E community. That's about as far as he went. His work was picked up by many scholars throughout the 19th century in Germany, which was really the locus of the best scholarship being done on the Hebrew scriptures. And the most famous name of the middle 19th century, a name that is still lives on in opprobrium in the mouths of more conservative Christians, was Julius Wellhausen, spelt with a W. So Wellhausen, H-A-U-S-E-N. He died in 1917, but most of his major work was done in the 1880s. And with him we get the what we'll call the triumph of higher criticism. Triumph means that that consensus is accepted across the board in the major universities, professorates, if you will, in Germany, and then more and more in England and in North America. He fleshes out the work of his predecessor Eichhorn and comes up with at least four strands that get woven into the whole of Tanakh, especially, however, the Torah and the what we call the prophets, which includes both history and prophets. I should say why we say Tanakh, having promised you that. Tanakh is an acronym. It crunches together, if you will, three words. The abbreviations would be TNK. We translated that into our Roman script. And the T stands for?
Torah,
the first five books of the Tanakh. So this will be called, by the way, T-A-N-A-K-H, Tanakh. So Torah is, the word for five in Greek is pente, like pentagon, right? And the one of the words for book in Greek, aside from biblos, is the neuter word teukos, teukos. And if you put pente in front of that, five books, we'd call it the Pentateuch. So that's the fancy Greek and mostly Christian name. Torah would be the Jewish name for that. We can in turn divide the Torah, which is Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, all in the traditional received history, written by Moses before he died. So sometime in the 1200s, let's say, Moses dies at least by the end of 1200 in the received history. But we find out that, no, there's this Deuteronomy book, which probably goes back to 620 or so CE, is written by a very separate school or author, set of authors, who have a particular agenda in mind, that Leviticus and Numbers, so we'll call that the D tradition, Leviticus and Numbers is written clearly by some clergy because it represents priestly interests in cult and somewhat tedious, boring things about issues about how to conduct yourself as a really observant Jew and what kind of cultic practices we should engage in. We find out that the name Elohim, that the name Yahweh, is first used in the third chapter of Exodus, Moses having fled Egypt because he murdered an Egyptian soldier. Fled the desert, finds at Mount Horeb the burning bush that doesn't get consumed by the fire. God appears to him in some form or other, perhaps as a voice, as an inner voice, we don't know. And he says his name, but his name is mysterious. I am who I am would be one translation of Yahweh, right? Whereas up here in Genesis, we find out that this same priestly, I should have put in the P there, the same priestly authors of Leviticus and Numbers also have a hand in writing the Genesis stories, as well as the Eloist. So we've got, these are interwoven at times, especially up here. So what we've got is an interesting, complex discovery of different communities at different times writing something, which will get redacted into one book with one continuous narrative. That's the genius of whoever put this together. However, scholars are saying, at best, that took place around the 300s BCE. Well, anyway, you can see that with Wellhausen, we're taking some major steps into understanding the history of the Hebrew, the Jewish people in ancient Israel. And it's going to begin to stir up controversy about what went on. There's a question.
Yes. What evidence do we have that there were different authors, as you've indicated?
What evidence do we have that there were different authors? And the word author is difficult to use. I mean, should not perhaps be used. What we have are editors, redactors, who no doubt draw upon oral traditions, scraps of history that we no longer have, for example, histories of the kings of Israel and Judah, and so on and so forth. The evidence that lets us sort out these four groups is the different literary style, the different names of God, the different concerns. The Deuteronomist, as we'll see, has a very different concern from the, not so different from the priestly, but from the Yahwist and the Eloist. So given that fourfoldness, we speak of authors, redactors, and obviously communities that they were speaking for. The same issue will repeat itself when we get to the Christian scriptures, which again, in the popular imagination, is sort of all written down with the gospel writers emailing each other and getting it right. It doesn't work that way. There are four very different readings of the life of Yeshua with different theologies and different propagandas to enforce. Another question,
when
please.
When was Letters and Numbers, or I'm sorry, Leviticus and Numbers written?
Well, as you read in Graba, who does the history of Israel, this is part of the controversy that we'll get to here. It's up on the coursework site, which is where you should be always checking for readings, right? He says nothing before the Persian period. Now, that means that there were legends, stories, traces, but the redaction, that's just a fancy word for the editing, putting in final form, the redaction takes place in the 300s. Now, that's this is not uncontroversial, but we'll let that stand for the moment. Another question, please.
Yes. In your, what you're calling the consensus, there's David and Solomon even exist as historical figures?
They've come on hard days. The question is, do David and Solomon, who are so famous in the Deuteronomic history, right, the first book, the two books of Samuel, the two books of Kings, etc., they who are such fascinating characters, I mean, they're beautifully drawn, have run upon problems in terms of their historicity. We'll talk about that in a moment. The best book on that is Israel Finkelstein and, I forget his first name, Silberman. It's called David and Solomon. Unfortunately, it's out of the library now, but you can find that around, and it's really one of the most wonderfully written, but full of information as to why archaeologically, this is the controversy, as I say, between text and archaeology, certainly David and Solomon didn't exist in the forms in which they're presented. We have no evidence of them. There's one mention of the house of David, and on a plaque that we found recently, was found recently at the Tel Dan up by the Lebanon border. But that's the only time that we have word of David before, you know, we have no archaeological evidence other than that. And there are other reasons that I can't go into just now, but I will in a moment, if I may, about why the story about the monarchy is a construction made after the return from the exile on the part of the Jewish people in order to rewrite their history. The third figure that we is worth mentioning as a giant in the revision of our view of the text. Remember, you said there's a literary component that we're working on here. That is Hermann Gunkel, G-U-N-K-E-L, who died in 1932, but did most of his work in the early 1900s. Hermann Gunkel takes a step beyond Wellhausen and Eichhorn. They wanted to do higher criticism of the text. But Gunkel correctly said, I want to know what was the history behind the text. Can we find in the text reflections of how they lived? His method, he's the originator of this method, is called form criticism, or sometimes form history. And it was taken up by 20th century New Testament scholars like Bultmann and Debelius, and we'll see about how what they did with it. Form criticism, or the history of forms. What he finds in so much of the literature of Tanakh is that there are inserted distinct little pericopes, stories that can be carved out and taken out of the Tanakh, and perhaps existed independently and were put there in order to flesh out the narrative. And he wanted to first find out what the forms of those pericope. A pericope means literally in Greek a cutout. Peri means around and koptein means to cut, so to cut around and take out. So these cutout stories, legends, proverbs, hymns, were obviously in the culture of the redactor. They might have even been in the culture of the time that the redactor is writing about. So he wanted to find out what those forms were and to locate what he called their situation in lived experience. In German, we call it Sitz im Leben, their context in the living, in the lives of the people who use those hymns, etc. So the history of forms or form criticism takes you back behind the text and starts to look for the popular ways that people used literature before it got incorporated into the Tanakh. And that opened a whole new door. Now you're back outside of the somewhat elite, intellectualized, priestly cultures that put all of these things together, and you're beginning to touch the popular folk culture from which the priestly tradition drew. Now that's interesting in its own right, because most literature from ancient cultures is obviously written by an elite. Not everyone knows how to write until well into our century, or to read, right? So what you've got are the intellectuals writing it. Well, intellectuals always have an agenda. And intellectuals are not famous for being populists. So they exclude a lot of things. If you look throughout the prophets in Tanakh, in the Nevi'im section, we didn't flesh out what the N and the K mean. N means Nevi'im, means the prophets, right? Like the Yiddish word Nebish, right? Comes from the Nevi'im. They're the prophets. And Ketuvim means the writings. So the Psalms, Proverbs, the stories of Ruth, and Lamentations, and Baruch, etc., fit in there. Those are the three divisions of the Hebrew Bible. But to go back to my point, elitists organize religion, and they like it organized around the temple, thank you. They like it organized around them, frankly. And what do they exclude? Folk religion. And in the condemnations of folk religion, the god Baal of the Canaanites, or Baal's consort, Asharte, and many other various names she has. Right? They're the bad guys, the bad gods of the priestly Deuteronomic tradition, right? And yet, what's going on there? The elitists are excluding folk religion, which is not the religion of the temple, it's not the religion of official clergydom, it's the religion of the people in the village. And whose religion is it in particular? It's mostly women's religion. they're a voiceless group, right? It's a man's world, and certainly the priestly caste is entirely male. But wait a minute. She's the one who bears the child. She's the one who nurses the child. She's the one who helps to bury the dead. All of those hearth and home issues. She's the one that looks after the garden behind the house, right? These are women's issues, to generalize grossly. And she is no doubt, and we now know archaeologically, had in the house images of these female earth goddesses, the goddess of childbirth, the goddess of menstruation and female functions, etc., right? They have a goddess who's looking after that. But I, the priest, in downtown Jerusalem, let's say, I'm going to condemn those kinds of practices and call them unacceptable. But we have archaeological excavations near Hebron where there is Yahweh and his consort. And she is that female Canaanite god. Well, those are the high places, the high altars, the bamot, that the priestly caste wanted to destroy. And every once in a while, under Hezekiah and then under Josiah in the southern kingdom, as we'll see, they did try to destroy those places, but archaeologists have been able to find them. So again, you've got archaeology beginning to be a strong counterweight against the received history through the scriptural text. Let's let that stand for these three major figures, Eichhorn, Wellhausen, Gunkel. They're not the only ones, there are many disciples, etc. But I think it gives you some sense of the revolution that went on in the 19th and early 20th centuries over just the literary side of these two bits of information, these two sources of information, scripture versus archaeology and history. Let's go to the second controversy, which is within archaeology itself. And this brings us up to more recent date. Archaeology is, of course, a new science. It goes back into the 1700s. It was usually done badly until recently, right? People often looted sites that they were supposed to be discovering, etc. And let me mention the major figures of the 20th century and how their paradigm has shifted. Perhaps two of the most famous names in ancient Israel archaeology are, first of all, William Albright. William Foxwell Albright, to be exact, who worked between 1921 and his death in 1971. He kept going. He was born in 1891, so as a young man, he devoted his whole life to archaeological digs in what we would now call Israel in the West Bank. He got his doctorate from Johns Hopkins, and his disciple, who follows in that same tradition, is George Wright, George Ernest Wright. These were the two real heavies among scores of others who followed in their footsteps and picked up their work and often corrected their work. Their premise, which is the previous paradigm, if you will, we're talking about past paradigms here, their premise, which had a tremendous impact in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, right up to Albright's death, was, let's see if we can find some correlation between the history that is recounted in the scriptures and what we can find archaeologically. Let's use the scriptures as a clue, as a magnifying glass that will send us to the spots that we can start to dig. And they did a lot of digging in and around Israel and Palestine. But of course the problem, I'm leaping ahead now, not reciting the many things that they found that are still of great scientific interest, but the question would be, what if the scriptures and Tanakh are not our kind of history? Now, they weren't ignorant of that fact, but what if it is a sacralized history, a theological or theocratic history? And secondly, what if it's a history that is written after the fact, as all history is, but written to reconstruct a past and to idealize it for the purpose of the people today who need some sort of historic foundation for their religious experience? That's the real problem. Here we run up against the difference between secular history and sacred history. Sacred history means religious, mythical, legendary, theocratic, propagandistic history, as contrasted with profane or secular history, which is says that history is not run by the one God who has a beginning and an end and he controls everything in the middle, but history is a mess. It is all done by humans. A lot of it is done by accident. And then afterwards, we put it together in a package and declare that to be the interpreted historiographical meaning of the past. And it's worth noting in a footnote that for the last 2.5 millennia, the sacred history model has dominated our Western view of history, even in secularized forms in the Enlightenment and after. And certainly among our conservative fundamentalist brethren, it continues to govern their view of secular history today. That's why they, the fundamentalist brethren, knowing that King Jesus is going to rule Israel at the end, are very happy to support the state of Israel, often to the detriment of the Palestinians, right? Because for them, there's an overarching story about how the foundation of the state of Israel in May of 1948, May and June, is only a step to King Jesus's agenda of finally offering the Jews one last chance, and if they don't accept, killing them. It's as stark as that. Now, they don't say that when they go to help Israel, but I think the Israelis are quite smart enough to realize that they can use their support and funding without having to hold to their theology. But I'm trying to say, sacred history still impacts secular history and secular politics today. The Albright right model really came into hit upon now hard days and rocky roads in the last 30 years of archaeological history, as I say, both in Israel and outside. Within Israel, the most famous name is the one that I already mentioned, Israel Finkelstein, whose book, The Bible Unearthed, and whose more recent book, David and Solomon, which I just mentioned, are really, to put it quite simply, shocking to the conservative religious sentiments of observant Orthodox Jews in Israel, because it basically has scientifically pulled out groundwork for what was presumed to be the foundations for the ownership of the state of Israel. And among the non-Israeli European and American archaeologists, Philip Davies, this basically the University of Sheffield in England, Philip Davies and also the University of Copenhagen have been doing the most work on this, and William Deaver, who I think is at the University of Arizona. Those are the major names among many others. What are the questions that they have presented us with that would raise issues about our traditional received view? Let's put them as questions. Is there any credible evidence, now we're looking at archaeology, not at sacred text here, that Abraham existed, that he and his wife at whatever age had a son named Isaac and a grandson named Jacob, who was eventually renamed Israel? Is there any credible evidence that the Exodus took place? The Book of Numbers says there were 600,000 Hebrews who left Egypt sometime in the 1200s under the leadership of Moses. That the Exodus took place, that these 12 tribes wandered through the desert of Sinai, parked themselves in southeastern Jordan area, that after Moses' death, his follower Joshua entered into the land of Canaanites, and after some defeats, defeated them in the, what we call the conquest. Is there any credible evidence that David and Solomon existed as the kings that they are portrayed in the book of Samuel and the books of Samuels and Kings, that they founded a united monarchy that then divided into a north and south monarchy? We'll see a little bit of this in after the break. Is there any credible evidence that most Jews were deported to Babylon in 587, that they spent the better part of that century there until 539, and then many of them returned to the land of Judah, there to rebuild the temple that had been destroyed in 587 and to reconstitute Judaism? To put it briefly and bluntly, the evidence is mounting, the consensus is virtually conclusive that the answer to all of those questions is no, that we have no evidence, credible evidence, prior to the 300s, which is the Persian Hellenistic period. Now, there's debate going on, trust me, within the range of what I call professional scientific historians and archaeologists. Forget about the debate between those people and fundamentalist religionists, whether they're Jewish or Muslim or Christian, right? We'll leave that aside. These are people who would never get a position as professor at a good university in the United States or elsewhere, these people are, whether we like it or not, the scientific professoriate. They're the ones who get the grants, they're the ones who get the prizes, they're the ones who get the jobs. You might want to say it's a conspiracy. I don't happen to think it is, but nonetheless there is that contradiction which we won't even look at. And then within their own field, while we'll speak of, I'm inventing these terms, an 80% consensus, there's still 20% of people who are trying in some way to modify it. But Finkelstein, Davies, Graba, whom you've read, Deaver, etc., have just pulled the rug out from what was the received history about ancient Israel. After the break, what I'd like to do is show you some slides at long last. I should have known that they wouldn't come up until the second half. And then what I would like to do is go into a particular period of post-exilic Judaism and illustrate by the book of Daniel how history gets written, rewritten, and what we mean by history in Tanakh. All right, we're now at the second hour of our second week meeting. And what I would like to do here is show you some slides and explain them as we go along that would indicate the geography of the area that we're talking about, and then to give you the received history, and then we'll comment on the problems with the received history, if I can put it that way. The slide that you're now looking at simply shows the current state lines of countries in the Middle East, which you're very familiar with, I'm sure. This takes us back some 3,000 years to what is called the Fertile Crescent. There is a series of mountains that surrounds this Fertile Crescent. They run from where Iran touches the Gulf, the Persian Gulf. They go up into more or less the area of Turkey. And short of those mountains, there is rainfall. And that rainfall, of course, makes it possible for people to come down from the mountains and to begin to cultivate that area, mostly barley and wheat, and therefore to subsist. Egypt, by contrast, has a yearly flooding, and therefore they're guaranteed their crops. There'll be bad floods or less good floods, but they're basically guaranteed the fertility of the Nile River. It's not that way in the Fertile Crescent. Therefore, they had to learn about irrigation in order to make the best use of the land that they could. It's this whole area, which would be called Mesopotamia between the Euphrates and the Tigris, all the way over into southern Turkey and down into what is now Syria, Lebanon, and Israel, Palestine, and into Egypt with a little break of desert there, that has been traditionally called the Fertile Crescent. Here is a slide that shows the major divisions of history that we can be fairly sure of. The Copper Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age delineate the tool use of peoples. So the Copper Age extending from about 4500 to 3200, and that's also the period of the old empires in Mesopotamia and in Egypt. In Mesopotamia, it's going to be Syria, Sumer, rather, then it's going to be Assyria, it's going to be Babylon, etc. The Bronze Age, bronze, of course, being copper mixed with tin, makes for better weapons and better tools, etc. The Iron Age, from 1200 onwards, down to our own time, the Steel Age and so on and so forth, saw the rise of new empires in Assyria, which would be what we call Kurdistan today, Babylon, Persia, the Greek Empire, then an interlude where the Jews rule themselves under the Hasmonean kings between 134 CE and 63 CE, and then conquest by the Romans in 63 CE, and the conquest that continued up until the invasion of the Muslims in around 638 CE. These dates are hard dates, if I can put it that way, in secular scientific history. This would indicate more or less, the title of the slide is Israel and Her Neighbors in around the year 2000 BC. Now there was no Israel, so we have to accept that that this is a fairly rough view of things. The Babylonians, in the south of what is now Iraq, the Assyrians up in the north and northeast, the Hittites in Turkey, the Hurrites in southern Turkey, the Amorites, who moved into Canaan about the time of 2000, and of course the Egyptians. The next slide shows you the received history. If we went by the Bible, by Tanakh, this would be the received history of what went on. There are three major periods delineated in this slide. The age of the patriarchs, the age of the sojourn in Egypt of the Hebrew nation, and the age of the exodus from Egypt until the conquest of Canaan. So the first period, traditionally, and I underline that, is dated from 2000 to 1700 BCE. It's the period of the fathers, and Av means father, Avot means is the plural for fathers. It's the period of the patriarchs. Abraham and Sarah, at a very late age and by a miracle from God, produce Isaac, who marries Rebecca. Their child, the most important of their children, is Jacob, who is also called Israel after he wrestles with an angel, which is to say with God. He who struggles with God, Israel. He had four wives or consorts, and from those four wives came 12 children that are the traditional children of the traditional 12 tribes of Israel. No date on the sojourn in Egypt, but traditionally the Exodus is put in the late 1200s, and the conquest of Canaan in the 1100s, and the rule by judges, who were tribal chieftains ruling over the so-called 12 tribes of Israel in the 1000s. But then, according to the traditional historiography, the Israelites demanded a king. And as much as Saul the prophet tried to say, you're looking at wars, you're looking at taxation, you're looking at, you know, they said, no, we want a king. And then came the period of the monarchy. This is the first part of the received history. In the received history, Abraham travels from what would be the area of Basra now, southern Iraq, Ur being the city, and he traveled up to the city of Haran, which is now only a tell, a dig, in southeast Turkey. There's an alternate location of Ur of the Chaldees that not too many hold to up there. In any case, in Haran his father dies, and God calls him, come to Canaan, go to Canaan. There I will do two things. I will have you bear many children. You will be the father of many nations. And secondly, you will own that land of Canaan all the way as far as the Mesopotamian rivers. That's the claim made in Genesis more than once. Abraham then travels south, probably passing through what is today Damascus, and his first stop is in Shechem, which is near, basically, near Ramallah. And there he builds an altar, and he worships the god El. Now, not yet the god Yahweh, and no doubt the god of the Canaanites. He was not a monotheist yet, and he was not a Yahwist, right? Then he moves through what is Salem, or contemporary Jerusalem, and settles in Hebron, which is just to the east of that Gaza there. Made a trip into Egypt and back, but basically Hebron is his territory. You see here in this next slide a map of what the land of Canaan would have looked like when Abraham was there. I'm asking you to notice less the Canaanite tribes that are there, and more the topography of the land. You'll notice that the River Jordan, of course, comes from the Sea of Galilee or Gennesaret down to the Dead Sea, right? And just to the west of that, there is a ridge of mountains or hills, right, that runs down and forms the spine, if you will, of contemporary Israel-Palestine. Let me point to Jerusalem, to Bethel, Bethel, where Abraham built another shrine. Bethel, rather, is near contemporary Ramallah, and Shechem is near Nablus, today's Nablus, right? So this would be the West Bank, called in contemporary language Samaria and Judea, right? Here's Jerusalem, and here's Hebron, where Abraham settled. So He settles in the hill country. Here is the next slide shows a satellite picture of that same land looking from the south towards the northeast. So we're standing more or less over the Negev Desert, just at the very southern part of contemporary Israel, and we're looking north towards the Jordan River, which flows into the Dead Sea. And again, I'm having you look at this mostly so that you get a sense of the topography. Hill country running down the spine, and then lowlands, plains along the coast. Let's see if I can point out towns here that are important. Why can I not find Hebron here? I'm not having a lot of success, but you get the idea. Can you see it? All right, then you guys can see it there. Good. Here is the same area, but seen from the northeast looking towards the southwest. So we're standing over western Jordan, the country of western Jordan, and we're looking down into the Dead Sea. You'll notice how much of the south part of the Dead Sea is salted up, silted over, if you will. Over here would be where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found by Qumran. I can't see as well. Here's the Jerusalem, right? Over there is Hebron. I can't make my finger touch it. And the hill country of Judah. Hebron is higher in elevation than Jerusalem. Jerusalem sits in a little bit of a saddle before, again, the hills start up for Ramallah up to Nablus and Jenin. Here, again, is a slide that shows the received history following upon the received history that we saw earlier. The three events of earlier were the patriarchs around 2000 to 1700, the sojourn in Egypt, the exodus, wanderings, and conquest sometime between 1250, let us say, and 1000. According to the received history, as found in the two books of Samuel, two books of Kings, and in part in the two books of Chronicles, Saul was the first king. He is king sometime around the year 1020. He commits suicide. David succeeds him and unites the north and the south of Canaan in a united kingdom. So it's really only with David that we get the united kingdom. And he rules until 962 when he's succeeded by his son Solomon, 962-961, who builds a temple, a major temple, the first temple in the city of Jerusalem. He dies in 922, having made enough enemies at the end that the united kingdom breaks down into the northern and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom assumes the name Israel, and it's made up of 10 of the 12 tribes. The southern kingdom is called Judah, and it's made up of only two of the tribes, Judah and Benjamin, the two tribes descended from those two descendants of Jacob. The northern kingdom will fall to Assyria in 721, so 200 years. It was much larger than the south. The southern kingdom will fall to the successor of Assyria, Babylon, in 587, late July. That's the received history. According to that received history, David's kingdom was immense. It was even an empire. It stretched all the way from the Sinai Desert through Jordan, Syria, well into what is now Turkey, with two exceptions along the Mediterranean coast. The Canaanites lived in that southern area there, which would be Gaza, a little north of it, and the Phoenicians lived in the upper area, what would now be Lebanon and the coast up to Antioch. So the United Kingdom close up would look like Judah and Israel united under one king who rules from Jerusalem. Worship is centralized around Jerusalem. Administration is centered around Jerusalem. And this kingdom would become famous in the scriptures, again in sacred history, under his son Solomon. You see here in this slide the white areas controlled by David before he began to expand, and the grayer areas showing the expansion of David's kingdom empire to the south and to the north. There's the dividing line, according to the traditional history, between the kingdom of Judah in the south, ruled by the house of David, and the kingdom of Israel, which took as its capital Shechem, and then it moved a couple times after that. You see the three shrines, Jerusalem, Bethel, Shechem. There was another shrine at the very north of the kingdom of Israel, which was called Dan, or Dan, and it's there at the Tell, that is to say the hillock that has been excavated of Dan, that the only textual evidence outside of the scriptures of a house of David is found. It's not about David himself, but about his successors. Here again are the two kingdoms, Judah in the south, Israel in the north, Philistia and Phoenicia along the coast. Judah is quite small in comparison with Israel, which extends all the way from virtually Damascus into Jordan and down right to almost the borders of Jerusalem. All of that is part of the received history. Now we come back to secular history, received sacred history. Three empires are worth remembering, and you'll probably have to think of an acronym for them. I wish it were ABC, but it's ABP. Assyria, Babylonia, and Persia. Babylonia is fairly brief. Assyria and Persia are the big ones. So I usually remember it by a bad period for the Israelites, ABP, or a bad patch for the Israelites, because they're conquered by these empires and will never again be independent, except for that brief Hasmonean period from 143 to 63 CE, a very small, reduced kingdom. They'll never again be independent as Israelis, let's say, or Israelites, until the summer of 1948. The first empire that comes through is the Assyrian Empire. It had existed before in the back in the 3000s, in the third millennium, but now this is a neo-Assyrian Empire, and it comes on with a vengeance. Out of Nineveh, its capital, which is up in the very northern part of Iraq now, and it swoops down into through Syria, Israel, Jordan, and you see how far it got. It attacked the northern kingdom in 721 and defeated them, and allegedly hauled off into deportation the 10 tribes of Israel, the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom. We all know, of course, that they ended up in North America. Read the Book of Mormon. But they disappear from history at that point in 721. Although, again, deportation was usually only of the useful people, the people who had skills, or the people who could do the work that they needed. But they weren't going to haul off a bunch of people to eat their crops and be fed unless they were useful. In the same way that immigration in the United States, official immigration, is often requires some sort of competence or need on the part of the U.S. So doctors from Pakistan, nurses from the Philippines, and laborers to cut your lawns, pick your fruit. So the Assyrian Empire made of the southern kingdom basically a vassal. So they still have their own king, but they're hardly as powerful as before. In 607, 606, the Assyrian, is this what I wanted? No, I didn't think I want this one. In 606, the Assyrian Empire is succeeded by the very brief Neo-Babylonian Empire. Remember again, back in the third millennium, there was an incipient Babylonian Empire in various configurations. But here comes the Babylonian Empire with a vengeance, and it attacks Jerusalem twice, and the second time laid siege to it for 18 months, between January, as far as we can tell, 588, until July of 587, and then it collapses. Jerusalem collapses. The Temple of Solomon, according to the received history, is burned. There's no remnant ever found of it. Those who say it was there would say that it's not found because Herod rebuilt the temple in 38 CE. Others would say it never existed. In any case, Judah, the kingdom of Judah, is destroyed, and according to the received history, hundreds of thousands of Jews are deported to Babylon. Probably the vast majority stayed in Judea, and only intellectuals and elite people who could serve the court of the Babylonian emperor, were transported to Babylon. Babylonian Empire is basically short-lived by comparison with the Assyrian, and it's followed by, out of Persia, the Persian Empire. Cyrus the Great. Let's see, that one keeps coming back. I can't read it. The Persian Empire. My God, that really is an empire. It stretches all the way from India to the shores of the Aegean. And as you may remember from your Greek history, they come across the Aegean and attack the Greeks twice. First at Marathon, where they're defeated. Then they go home and stew in their juices, right? Then they come back and attack again, burning the city of Athens, and finally being defeated at the Battle of Thermopylae. And that, those two battles are the brilliant Renaissance period, if you will, of classical Greek culture. In any case, here's the Persian Empire. And in 538 or 9, Cyrus the Great liberates from Babylon those Jews who want to return to Judah. The Jews call him the Messiah, the anointed one of God who has come to liberate them. It's the only time in which the word Mashiach is used of a non-Jew. But you can see, liberator, someone who brings the blessings of God, is the meaning of Mashiach. So Cyrus Christ, I guess we should call him, if we translated his name into Greek. Kuro, it would be Kyrios Christos, if we said it in Greek. He allows the Jews to return to, the elite to return to Judea, and now they've got the task of what we, this is the birth of what we would call Judaism. No longer ancient Israel, no longer having the glorious temple of before, the beginnings of synagogue worship, which may have already started in Babylon at the time. Traditionally, Ezra and Nehemiah are the ones who pull the people together, rebuild the temple in a reduced form. It will then be glorified by Herod the Great in 38 CE. Right? And they live under Persian domination from 538 or 9 until 333. So if we round that out from 500 to 300, 200 years, two centuries, they're under Persian rule. And at this point, in terms of extra scriptural evidence, we have virtually a complete blackout. We don't know what was going on in Judah at the time. We do know that when they came back, they got into a fight with people who were living in what would be the Shechem, Bethel Shechem area, especially Shechem, which is at that time called Samaria, right? And they wouldn't allow those people to participate in whatever rebuilding of the temple took place, because they felt that they had either cooperated too much with the Babylonians or the Assyrians, so they basically cut them off. So they, in retaliation, build their own temple in Samaria and separate from the Jews. The Samaritans and the Judeans then become two, as it were, ideologically warring factions. Well, I think I want another picture. Darn, I don't think I've got it. I was going to, well, let's see if I can go back. Well, we'll just call it here at this point. I had another slide that I wanted to show, but doesn't seem like it wants to work. We'll just close this now. There we go. All right. In the time that remains, let's see if we can do something here. I'm not filling you in. I'm turning you over to the literature. And one of the colleagues suggests that there is much less of a consensus among the members of the biblical scholars that he knows and visits and listens up to than I was alleging. That may be the case. Not being an expert, I can only sort of recite what I find among those people who seem to be at the top of the field. But I can't say, I did say, and I shouldn't have said, 80% consensus, 20% disagreement. Maybe it's more like 40-60, and I'm not sure which side is winning. So we can put that as a more modest depiction of it. But it's worth observing that the old-time religion that we absorbed or learned about based on old-time history from the scriptures is certainly in debate and doubt now, both among Jews and Israelis and among non-Jews, non-Israelis, whether they're Christian or not. I would like to talk a little bit about that Persian and Alexandrian period. We didn't get to Alexander, somehow the slide didn't show up there. Persia rules until 333, and then the revenge of Greece. It's two centuries late, but Alexander, I'll make it up, in vengeance for the Persian attack upon Hellas, Greece, right? attacks through Turkey down into, and defeats the Persians mightily there, down into Syria, into Egypt, therefore he conquered what we would now call Judea and Samaria, right? Then starts to move right into the heart of the Persian Empire, and that is to say through Iraq into Persia itself, kills the Persian emperor king, and keeps on going, as you well know, into Afghanistan, Tajikistan, all of the stands, right? Goes down partially into India, but his soldiers are getting tired. This is incredible. This is a 30-year-old guy with soldiers like Napoleon. They'll follow him anywhere, but they get a little bit tired. So he returns to Persepolis, and probably in an accident of drunken revelry, they burn down Persepolis, the capital of the Persian kingdom. Whether it was by accident or design, I'm not prepared to say. That initiates, let's say 333, soldiers rounded around to 300, that initiates the Greek period of domination of that whole area, and specifically of Judea and Samaria. And since the Greeks don't call their country Greece, they call it Hellas. So it's the Hellenistic period, right? They don't use our Latin word, Graeca, or Grecia, right? So they use their own word. So we speak of the Hellenistic period. And it's a very interesting, complicated period where you have people either fighting against Greek culture or cooperating with Greek culture, not that they want to be dominated by the Greeks, but because Greek money, language, economy, politics becomes a lingua franca, whereby these somewhat subservient nations, tribes, countries can enter into, yes, globalization, the first, well, not the first, but a recognizable form of globalization. They can become part of a world political order, social order, and economic order. Eventually, Alexander's empire breaks down into three Greek components. The Ptolemies take care of Egypt. The Seleucids take care of eventually what would become basically Syria and Israel, Palestine, down the coast there. And the Diotiki, the 12 general followers, take care of parts like Iraq and Iran. I can't draw that figure for you very well. We're interested in the Seleucid dynasty, which ruled from Antioch. Antioch was the major city, Damascus a minor city in those days of Syria. They ruled from there. In 175, now we're getting, this is getting to the important stuff that Graba talks about. In 175, a new Seleucid king named Antiochus IV took the throne. He's trouble. And he's been with us right down to our own day. If you read the Left Behind series or the Left Behind movies or any of that kind of stuff, who they're really talking about is not somebody who's going to run the United Nations. It's actually Antiochus IV. I'd like to explain that to you in the brief time that we have and then pick it up again, because it illustrates how history got written and rewritten. Already by the 300s, the priestly redactor was pulling together the J tradition of the southern kingdom, which glorifies David and Abraham, the E tradition of the northern kingdom, which glorifies Jacob and Israel. He's beginning to weave it together. He, they are beginning to weave it together into a brilliant, unified national epic that runs from Adam through Abraham down to King David and down to the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians. It is, I think, one of the greatest literary creations alongside of Iliad, Odyssey, alongside of Aeneid, alongside of, in a very different light, Dante's Inferno, but to create a history for a nation, to invent parts of it in order to idealize and glorify the past the way all archaic writers did, so as to give hope to a people today who are repressed, oppressed, right, and say that could be born again. The glorification of the kingdom of David as a united kingdom is really proleptic. Proleptic means looking into the future, creating a past in order to create a future. History works differently. Historiography works differently in archaic ancient civilizations than it does from ours. But in a sense, we still rewrite the past in order to make us the winners, don't we? We write it from the point of view of the present. They wrote it from the point of view of the present and the future. As the old Soviet Union joke used to go,
We are not worried about the future. It's the past that keeps changing. You know, who gets cut out of the photograph, who gets thrown out of office, etc. Well, the past kept changing. In the 600s, when we're sure there was a kingdom of Judah, whether it had ever been a united kingdom, we're sure that there's a kingdom of Judah in the at least the 600s, and a kingdom of Israel. Two reforming kings, Hezekiah in the 700s and Josiah in the 600s, decide to centralize worship. Because worship, I mean, they weren't like spiritual people. Worship was politics, right? There was no separation of religion and state. It was a theocratic culture. God was on the side of the king, the divine right model of kingship that comes down to our own day. And that's when they start to try to destroy the popular religious cult sites, the high places as they call them, outside of Jerusalem. They want to organize the whole kingdom around Jerusalem. So they're condemning the north because they occasionally have golden calves, even if those golden calves were nothing but platforms on which to place their god El, right? The invisible god El. No, 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 say these reformers, they're really worshiping golden calves. In fact, let's write that into the story about the wandering in the Sinai. In any case, Josiah did a wonderful thing, and it's been repeated ever since. You have to be brief here, and I apologize for the brevity, but I hope to pick it up in the future. Josiah's priests, since they're working tightly with him, these are very orthodox, traditional, theocratic priests, right? Have to figure out how they can get the people to reform religiously, which means politically. So, while they're doing some interior decorating and rebuilding of the temple, oh my goodness, they found a book. Let's see, where is the book? My God, it's right here, written by Moses. Jeez. Look, it's a whole new reiteration of the law. It's like a second law. The word for Greek, in Greek for second is deuteros. The word for law is nomos. So this book, discovered in 620, is called Deuteronomy. It's the fifth book. Now, I invite you to be a little bit suspicious. And the suspicion is this. Let's write this book, let's stick it in the temple, and then let's discover it. Something that happens again in the year 165, as we'll see. So, finally, back in the later period, the Persian, now the Hellenistic period, we're going to see the same sort of thing happen. So I'm both recalling how D appears as a text in the part of the Pentateuch, right? It's discovered in around the year 620. Now the book of Daniel, one of the most dramatic books in Tanakh, right? It comes under the Ketubim, under the writings, right? And it is the book that has inspired so many end-of-the-world fundamentalist scenarios. It's brilliant. And of course, it's inspiring those scenarios precisely because they're ignorant of why they wrote that book was written. Here's the way it works. On the board, I'm going to draw kind of a chronological line that extends from Babylon down to the persecution of Jews in the 170s and 160s under Antiochus IV. 175 to 165, I'm rounding things out, is a period of great persecution, growing persecution of the Jews. Some of the Jews want to be Hellenized. They want to be part of the global economy, the global society, and if necessary, even somewhat the global religion. So, in their enthusiasm to become Hellenized, and with the cooperation of Antiochus IV, the upper class, some of the upper class of Jewish society, built a gymnasium so they could exercise in the buff the way the Greeks do. And as anyone knows Jewish culture, you don't show up in the buff very, very publicly. So that's already an affront to traditional values. Some of them decide that showing up in the buff, they don't look very Greek because they're circumcised. So they invented an operation that I won't go into that reverses circumcision by a very painful stitching process. Another affront, too, the sign of the covenant, right, given to Abraham in the book of Genesis. And we have reports in the book of Maccabees,
the two books of the first two books of Maccabees, that there were no doubt that was the Fox News of the time, you know, maybe exaggerating a little bit, claiming that priests would sacrifice in the temple, then rip off their robes and run down to the gym, get naked, and start to exercise without, you know, proper purification and so on and so forth. In other words, you've got a culture war going on inside of Israel itself. Finally, in a long process, Antiochus IV declares himself to be God in the flesh. So he gives himself an epithet, Epiphanes. That means appearing right in front of you. So the idea is that he, Antiochus IV, is either Zeus appearing in your midst, Epiphanes, or maybe Apollo appearing in your midst, Epiphanes. And according to the tradition, he constructs, either inside or outside of the temple in Jerusalem, a statue of himself. Number one, no statues, thank you, in Jewish culture. Least of all, a statue of a pagan god pretending to be a god. Least of all, in the Holy of Holies or outside of the Holy of Holies. Outrage breaks out. Also, according to the tradition, he kills anyone who reads the Torah. And if a woman and her husband circumcise a child, kills the child, his soldiers, and then hangs the child around the neck of the mother. This is what you will read in the book of Maccabees, etc. Are we in trouble? We're in trouble. So a conventicle of priests, about whom we know nothing, gets together and says, we're really under the gun here. We need to write a book, like the book of Deuteronomy, that is to say, discover a book that was written a long time ago, just like the book of Deuteronomy was written by Moses in 1200. We just discovered it in 620. So they write a book, and they name it after a mythical figure who allegedly existed at the time of the Babylonian captivity and in fact became a counselor to the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar. And his name is Daniel. So they write a book, signing it Daniel, as it were. And in that book, he has visions that certainly will put your mind at rest, because he predicts all of the empires that ruled over Judah. He calls them four beasts. Right? And the last beast is on his way out, trust me. So this is the revelation given to Daniel. And in fact, I don't have my Tanakh with me, and so I'm going to get the numbers wrong. At the end of this book, which they just discovered, he promises that in something like 1,200 and help me, 42 days, it is going to be all over. It doesn't come, so he said, make that 1,310 days. They put a little appendix. And wouldn't you know it, as a matter of fact, the Maccabees do liberate the temple, purify and cleanse it, so the Feast of Hanukkah, right? Relighting the lights in the temple, purifying it from, and getting rid of that statue, which they call the Abomination of Desolation. It has a long history of the meaning of that name, and reconstituting Judaism, and eventually leading to the Hasmonean kingdom that stays free from 143 until 63. Let me give you an analogy, since time is running out. America is in great difficulty these days. I think we'd all agree. But guess what?
Yeah.
We were searching around in the National Archives, and oh my God, it's a book written by George Washington. Not only that, but he's got a vision in here in which the angel Columbia, dressed in red, white, and blue with stars, comes down out of heaven into his bedroom and says, "Don't worry, George. Tough times. The Brits are on our back, but I'm guaranteeing you that in 6 or 8 years, these funny guys that smell of garlic are going to come over, help us out. We're going to defeat them." You know, they're all illusions. They don't exactly take it. And then in your future, George, there's going to be an army. I see two armies, one dressed in gray and the other dressed in blue, and they're going to fight like mad, and the blues are going to win, and the grays are going to be defeated. Then there's going to be a great pilgrimage to a great ocean in the west of your country, and you will conquer all and throw out brown people and make it fill with white people. Okay? Then there will be two great wars, and in between them there will be a time of famine. you know, but a great man will say, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Then another great war will take place, and after that a great crusade against an evil beast that extends its claws from Siberia to Managua. Wow. And keeps going like that. And then, just as things get the worst that you can imagine them to be, your soldiers, George, will be caught in a foreign land. They'll be blown to bits by terrorists. Towers will crash. But don't give up, because in just 2 years, if you make the right decision, if your descendants make the right decision, you will be liberated. There will be two chickens in every pot, two cars in every garage, and happy times will be here again. Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't make this. This was found in the National Archives. Don't give up hope, no matter how dark things are. That's what's called revelation literature. Because here's a new revelation, and the Greek word for revelation is apocalyptic, apocalypse. In the 200 and following, it's a literature of the oppressed, it's a literature of liberation, not by the gun. These guys were not in favor of the Maccabees. They wanted a break-in from without. Also, they wanted to be able to predict when it was coming, just as fundamentalists today say, uh-huh, May of 48, that's a sign, the Jews are being gathered into the country, King Jesus is coming. Right? So they wanted to have revelations that pretended to prophesy the present, when really what they're doing is prophesying after it's already happened and making it sound mysterious so that we'll think that it was a real prophecy. Going back to Daniel, it's written in 165, 64 in downtown Jerusalem, someplace, right? In order to give people hope. And in this case, actually, they succeeded. Right? Antiochus IV his armies were thrown out, and he himself died in a campaign in the east. A whole new literature comes in, the literature of apocalypse. That's the context, not of all Jews of the Second Temple period, not of Yeshua, as I will argue, although that's another great debate, but it's the religion of many within the Jewish community, not the Sadducees, but the Pharisees, and lots of revolutionaries, and maybe to a certain extent, the people who hang around with Yeshua in Galilee and Capernaum. So, whereas before the exile, we had prophets saying, get your act together, get your act together. We had reforming priests saying, let's organize religion around the thing here. But we're hoping that God will come and be a present to us. Now, in a period of desperation, we start to predict a radical inbreak where God's going to put an end to the whole history of oppression, and he's going to send a blessed one, an anointed one, a Messiah, a Mashiach, who will reestablish the kingdom of David. Now, we've got all these texts that tell us how glorious it was. It's going to be even better when the Mashiach, the new anointed one, comes. Apocalypse is based on a two-era, two-period, two-age view of the world with a big crash and burn in the middle, which will be God's revelation of himself, God's apocalypse. And writing literature about that is apocalyptic literature. And we'll show that in Mark's Gospel 13, we have a Christian apocalypse. In the book of Revelation, we have a Christian apocalypse. So that literature, that view of the world was around at that time. And we have to find whether or not Yeshua shared in it. I will argue for the negative, but others will argue for the affirmative. So history is different in archaic cultures. The rewriting of the past is normal and typical. Only people who are dumb enough to read it literally to miss the point of these texts. And that's some of us, as a matter of fact, as we learn these new and controversial things about settled, what we thought were settled types in ancient Israel, right? But what we see is that they're more interested in the future, in the present and the future, and they rewrite the past to fit it, fit this here. So, I invite you to look at coursework and read the two texts that are up there, Meyer and Bultmann, and we'll make the transition from the Hebrew world into the Second Temple world and into Jesus the Jew who works in that world. But we'll start by finding out how Jesus got rewritten right after his death. So we're actually going to start after Yeshua and come back to Yeshua from that. I'll tell you why next time. Thank you. See you next week.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.